That was the year, recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year.
San Diego, California, January 26th.
All set, Glenn?
Yeah. Let go of that stern line.
Here she goes.
For the first time in history, man rose from the water in a heavier-than-air craft when Glenn H. Curtis took off from the Pacific Ocean, circled over Southern California, and settled back onto the sea.
Jefferson Barracks, St. Louis, Missouri, March 1.
Okay, Al.
Okay, here I go.
For the first time in history, man made a safe parachute jump from a plane when Captain Albert Berry leaped into space and descended 1,200 feet to the Earth.
Hendon, England, September 9.
All right. Get back there. Can't you see he's trying to put that bag into the blooming thing? Get back, I say. Off.
Are you ready, old chap?
Right-o.
Take it up, then, and good luck.
Giddy-o.
For the first time in history, man carried government airmail when, as a part of the celebration of the coronation of George V and Queen Mary, the first aerial postal service was inaugurated between Hendon and Windsor. A few weeks later, mail was carried by plane for the first time in the U.S. when Postmaster General Hitchcock carried a sack of government postal matter from Nassau Boulevard on the north shore of Long Island to Mineola on the south shore. Four first times for aviation in 1911.
And that was the year.
In the Supreme Court of the United States of America, number 398, the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, appellant against the United States.
Thus, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon of May 15, after the closing of the day's business in the Stock Exchange, did Chief Justice Edward Douglas White begin the reading of the long-awaited 20,000-word decision in the noted Standard Oil case. A decision which not only instructed the mammoth industrial empire founded and built by John D. Rockefeller to dissolve into its component parts, but which also handed down one of the most paramount legal tenets of the century, the decision of the Supreme Court in case number 398. For the first time since the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Law in 1890, legalized reasonable restraint of trade.
1911, that was the year.
Mexico City, May 25.
Respecting, as I have always respected, the will of the people, I come before the supreme representative of the nation in order to resign, unreserved, the office of International President of the Republic, with which the national vote honored me, which I do with all the more reason, since in order to continue in office, it would be necessary to shed Mexican blood, endangering the credit of the country, dissipating its wealth, exhausting its resources, and exposing its policy to international complications.
With this statement dictated from a sickbed, did 81-year-old José de la Cruz Porfirio Díaz, for 27 years president of the Republic of Mexico, finally acquiesce to an agrarian revolt led by Francisco Madero. Following his resignation, Díaz fled to Paris, where he died 3 years later. But he lived to see the financial stability, the international respect, The material prosperity which he had created crumbled under the weight of a succession of political revolutions.
That was the year.
The White House, Washington, D.C. President William Howard Taft, in a message to Congress concerning the proposed bill planning a reciprocal tariff between the U.S. and Canada, says,
"Since becoming a nation, Canada has been our good neighbor, immediately contiguous across a wide continent, without artificial or natural barrier except navigable waters used in common. She has cost us nothing in the way of preparations for defense, and she never will. She shares with us common traditions and aspirations. I feel I have correctly interpreted the wish of the American people by expressing their desire for a more intimate and cordial relationship with Canada."
July 26th.
The United States-Canadian Reciprocity Bill passes Congress and is signed by the President.
Ottawa, Canada, September 21.
Canada has rejected reciprocity with the U.S. Sir Wilfrid Laurier, Canada's premier, having staked his administration upon his support of the policy, looks upon defeat in the current Dominion election.
There is no doubt but that we have been decisively defeated. The electors have declared themselves, and I bow to their decision.
Upon receipt of the news of the defeat, said President Taft,
"I have just been informed that reciprocity has failed in Canada. For me, it is a great disappointment. I had hoped that it would be put through. It would be a good thing for both countries. It takes two to make a bargain, and if Canada declares against it, we can still go on doing business at the old stand."
1911, that was the year.
Madame Marie Curie, the Nobel Foundation herewith awards to you the Nobel Prize in the field of physics for the fiscal year of 1911.
Clad in the funereal black of a perpetually stoic widow, Marie Curie received from the hands of a foreign nation an award the value of which her adopted country, France, had several times denied her.
That was the year.
Los Angeles, California, December 5. District Attorney John D. Frederick sits in the office of County Jailer Gallagher, facing the two attorneys who have defended James and John McNamara, accused of bombing the building of the Los Angeles Times 17 months previously. One of the attorneys for the defense is internationally known criminal lawyer Clarence Suadero, the other his colleague Lacon Davis. At length, the door opens, and Jim McNamara is ushered in. After a moment of awkward silence, Darrow speaks.
"Jim, this is District Attorney Fredericks."
"I'm glad to meet you. You will appear in court Tuesday morning for sentence, and I want to get a signed statement from you concerning the charge to which you've pleaded guilty. I want to read it to the court, and I want you to write it in your own way and sign it."
"All right. I will write it. But I haven't a pen, though. Could I borrow yours?"
Laboriously, Jim McNamara writes his official statement, then hands it to the man who has successfully prosecuted the case against him.
"Can you read it all right? I'm not much of a writer."
"Yeah. Yes, Jim, I can read it all right. I'm pretty familiar with your handwriting. I note in this document several peculiarities which I've noted before. I know more about your handwriting than I do about my own. I could tell it anywhere. I noticed that peculiar S. I used to mark that in your signature when you used the alias of Sullivan. It appears in here, and the peculiarity is still there. I also observe that peculiar C. It isn't a capital in this document, but the strange stroke you used in this letter was one of the things which our experts remarked about. After you blew up the Times, you tried to change the way you wrote this letter, C. But we got that too, Jim. You tried too hard to deceive us."
That was the year.
On October 19, 39-year-old Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, together with four companions and 52 carefully selected dogs hauling four sledges, starts from latitude 80 degrees south to conquer 800 airland miles of blizzard-swept Antarctic waste. Over uncharted snows, over pitted glaciers, over polar mountains, travel the intrepid sons of the Vikings. Finally, on December 9, the weather clears. The sun beams down to guide them toward their undiscovered goal. On and on they speed the hardy expedition. On past the southernmost points reached by James Cook, by Bellingshausen, Weddle, Biscoe, and Bellany, past Gerville and Wilkes and Ross, past Lawson and Bruce and Scott, past the marks of Dr. Douglas Mawson and the martyred Shackleton. At last...
December 14, 1911.
Hold!
My friends, the goal is reached. The journey is finished. We are the first human beings to reach the South Pole. Hassel, give me the flag of Norway. I, Roald Amundsen, hereby claim this discovery in the name of my native country, Norway. And I hereby name this surrounding plain King Hakon's Plateau.
That night, drenched with the midsummer of a brilliant Antarctic sun, Amundsen and his companions celebrated the discovery of the South Pole by smoking tobacco, the first these hardy Norsemen had tasted since leaving their base 56 days previously.
1911. That was the year.
The dance steps took a zoological turn as the world danced to...
Thank you.